I will summarize the state of the art thus. Current thinking concludes that the peak of the emergence of intelligence in the galaxy was achieved 10 to 100 million years ago, that most races in the galaxy are very old and very sophisticated. We cannot expect such races to appear with a trumpet blast over every city on Earth. Such an entry into history is tantamount to crashing into someone's house completely unannounced, hardly the sort of thing that one would expect from a subtle and ancient galactic civilization. Rather, they have always been here, or rather, their presence has always been here in the hallucinogens. When we understand this on our own, we will be signaling to them that we are now ready for the contact. We can send that signal only by following the instructions of the seeded genes and building the necessary apparatus. When that is done, somewhere in the galaxy, lights will flash the message that yet another of the millions upon millions of seeded planets in the galaxy has achieved the threshold of galactic citizenship. Current estimates are that even in a galaxy teeming with intelligence, such a threshold is passed by an intelligent species only every 100 or 1,000 years. It is a joyous moment even for the galactarians. If such a speculation has any validity at all, then its very articulation signifies the final moment of the pre-contact phase, and signifies also the pressing need to attempt to explore the psilocybin trance and to understand the role that Stropharia cubensis is playing in the psychology of the human species. Recently, a new light has been thrown on the phenomenon of voices heard in the head and the role that they may play in the evolution of consciousness. Julian James of Princeton has written a most provocative book, The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. James uses 445 pages to lay out his ideas concerning the role that hallucinations, especially audio hallucinations, have played in the structuring of mind. Briefly, James believes that until the time of roughly the Iliad, around 1400 BC, nothing at all like modern ego-centered and individuated consciousness existed. Instead, he argues that people behaved like automata, or social insects, unconsciously going about the tasks of the hive. Only in moments of great stress and personal danger was this regimen broken. In such moments, an impersonal mind, outside the usual experience of the world, became manifest as a voice. According to James' theory, such voices were the guiding lights of human society, perhaps for millennia. Whether they were understood to be the voice of an absent but living king, or a dead king, an omnipresent god, or a personal deity, migrations and the breakdown of the cultural insularity of the early human civilizations brought an end to man's relations to the bicameral mind, which is Jane's term for the cybernetic godlike presence felt behind the hallucinated voices. Selective pressures and social prejudices against having a relationship with the bicameral mind in a modern context have made hearing voices into a mystical phenomenon or a serious mental aberration, in any case, something very rare. The interested reader should study James' case carefully, although his book is exasperating, since in a treatise on the role of hallucinations in human history, he fails to offer any serious discussion of hallucinogenic plant use at all. This is a serious failing, especially if the effect triggered by psilocybin is not, as I have suggested, a contact with an intelligence entirely distinct from ourselves. Jane's theory opens up the possibility that psilocybin returns one to rapport with the personified other in a way that duplicates, on some level, the state of mind that was characteristic of early human civilizations. It is reasonable to suggest that a voice in the head, interpreted by ancient man as a god, might be interpreted by a naive modern person as a telepathic contact with extraterrestrials. Whatever facts may eventually be known, psilocybin offers a tool that allows direct experience of this voice that explains all things, this logos of the other. Chapter 19, The Hawaiian Connection. The fall of 1975 was a time of personal change and consolidation. Kat, my old friend, met years before in Jerusalem during my opium and Kabbalah phase, became at last my lover. Tide pool traveler, the mushroom had made good its promise to send a partner to share the ongoing journey through the interior world. In October, we went to Hawaii to write and to plan a trip to the Peruvian Amazon in early 76. We had rented a house on the remote and desolate Kau district of the Big Island of Hawaii. It was an area of twisted lava flows of all ages. Kapukas, islanded areas of ancient forest, were the only vegetation and were surrounded by frothy seas of hardened rock that had killed all low-lying and less fortunate life. Slowly, nearly imperceptibly, Mauna Loa rose up to 14,000 feet in the distance behind us. We were at about 2,500 feet ourselves. Our small house fronted the vast and forbidding cinder fields, but the lot ran back into a kapuka whose enclosing shade and many birds and insects provided welcome contrast to the primal devastation that stretched in all directions for miles. Our life was leisurely. I wrote and did some experiments with further aspects of mushroom cultivation. Cat was immersed in doing the line drawings for the book on Stropharia cubensis growing. We were isolated, as we both loved to be, and we took mushrooms together and often. It was during that time in Hawaii that I determined to return again to the Amazon to track down Banisteriopsis capi in its native setting and to satisfy myself as to the role that it and the beta-carboline hallucinogens it contains played in the experience at La Churera. I was especially interested to know if other chemically different aboriginal hallucinogens provoked the same experience as did the mushroom psilocybin. I wanted to determine if our experiences were part of the general phenomenology of hallucinogens or were unique to psilocybin. Throughout that October and November in Hawaii, we took the Stropharia that we had grown at weekly or 10-day intervals. This was an amazing series of experiences. The psilocybin definitely conveys the impression that sometimes the hallucinations one is seeing are being seen with equal clarity by the other people around one. Kat and I satisfied ourselves that this was true by describing in turn the images in which we were immersed. At those times when the flow of images had a certain electric intensity, there was no doubt that we were seeing the same things. The relationship of the psyche to the surface of the body, the skin, is amazing under the influence of psilocybin. By having large areas of skin in contact, we seem to somehow obviate the usual psychic individuality and integrity of the body and would melt into each other's minds in a way that was immensely pleasant and full of unplumbed potential for human growth and parapsychological studies. It was wonderful to have someone to share the mushroom with. For until Kat had joined me, most of my mushroom experiences had been entirely alone, one soul adrift in the cosmic ocean. Happily, there were now two of us navigating together through the billows of jeweled and synesthetic geometries. Two of those mushroom trips stand out as especially memorable. The first occurred the evening of the 28th of November, 1975. We each ate 5 dried grams of Stropharia and then sat inside by the fire watching the slow upwelling of hallucinations from behind closed eyelids. I seemed to see fleeting but prophetic images of the trip that we were planning into the Amazon.